Tonight on the Daily Debrief, guilty on all counts, the verdict against the leader of a Mexican drug cartel. Plus, a surprise move in an Ohio quadruple murder. Is the death penalty off the table? Also, a confession in the death of a Georgia beauty queen.
This is how he carried her out.
And a key piece of evidence left behind. This is the Daily Debrief for Tuesday, February 12th.
Good evening, everybody. We have a packed panel tonight, so let's get straight to it. He tunneled under the border only to wind up going to prison. A federal jury in Manhattan today convicted Joaquin Guzman, better known as El Chapo, of all counts after a 10-week federal trial. An indictment accused El Chapo of 17 counts, some with multiple included violations. The counts included charges involving the drugs cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and marijuana. The other counts involve firearms, running a criminal enterprise, and laundering drug money. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross has been following this case start to finish. He's in the newsroom tonight with reaction to this verdict. Brian, good evening.
Well, good evening, Aaron. It took the jury 6 days of deliberation to reach its verdict, which carries a maximum one-year life sentence, a life sentence with no parole. As the U.S. attorney said, it's a sentence from which there is no escape and no return.
Tengo algunos años que he andado cuidándome en ciertas ciudades.
El Chapo's own words from an interview done with Sean Penn for Rolling Stone have been some of the most compelling evidence against him. Prosecutors have played portions of the tape for the jury several times, actually recorded while El Chapo was on the run as a fugitive. He made no excuses for his life running the powerful and brutal Sinaloa drug cartel and said his arrest and prosecution would make no difference.
No, el narcotráfico no depende de una persona, sino que depende de muchísimas personas.
More than 50 witnesses testified against El Chapo, his closest deputies, his accountant, even his IT guy who helped the DEA bug the boss's own phones, catching El Chapo negotiating some of his massive drug deals.
So El Chapo got his IT guy to spy on the people who work for him, and then the FBI got the IT guy to spy on El Chapo, which is a good lesson for everyone. Be nice to your IT guy. Yeah.
Also among the trove of evidence presented by federal prosecutors, some of El Chapo's ingenious smuggling plans. There was a submarine, trucks with hidden compartments, even plastic bananas stuffed with cocaine. But his most successful smuggling operations seemed to have involved tunnels that went under the Mexican border. The jury saw this video of a U.S. customs agent giving a tour of one of the tunnels. It came out on the U.S. side, less than 1,000 yards from a U.S. customs office.
To be clear, Aaron, it's a mandatory life sentence. El Chapo's lawyer said after the verdict, they plan to appeal.
Certainly, we expect them to do that. If they don't, it's probably going to be malpractice. But, Brian, you were there for much of this case. What was the mood when you were sitting there in court and when you were outside the courthouse watching these proceedings go on?
Well, there was an avalanche of evidence, written documents from El Chapo's own files, recordings of his conversations doing drug deals with dealers in New York and Chicago, of videos that he made with Sean Penn, as we just saw, and every conceivable way of moving drugs across the border. Notably, Aaron, the wall that's being proposed by President Trump would not seem to have stopped El Chapo. Most of his drugs came through tunnels under the wall, in boats around the wall, or right through legal ports of entry, where he paid huge bribes to customs officials on both sides of the border, law enforcement officials allegedly on both sides of the border, and testimony in the case revealed that at one point he paid a bribe of $100 million to the then president of Mexico, which the then president has since denied.
Wow, a lot of accusations in there, Brian. Some of the surprising evidence that we saw in your report there, plastic bananas, submarines, where did it end?
He had 1,000 different ideas, a sort of evil genius. He had all kinds of ways to move his material. It was cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and marijuana. He started with marijuana, and it grew and grew and grew. one of the points he made during his interview with Sean Penn, which is probably true, is that arresting and convicting one person like El Chapo doesn't stop the Sinaloa cartel. They're still in business. There's a new leader. And in fact, El Chapo's lawyers argued that, in fact, what was going on was that El Chapo was being made a scapegoat by the actual leader of the Sinaloa cartel. That's an allegation that the jury clearly rejected.
Look, I'm sure it will continue. I'm sure that's accurate, but authorities have a conviction on at least one of them. Brian Ross in the newsroom tonight. Thanks.
Thank you.
A shocking plan for a guilty plea this morning in a quadruple murder case where a defendant remains facing a possible death sentence. 24-year-old Aron Lawson of Ohio is accused of killing four people and trying to kill a fifth. The victims were Stacy Jackson Holston, her 8-year-old son Devin Holston, and her parents, Donald and Tammy McGuire. Tammy McGuire was this defendant's aunt. Lawson led authorities on a 36-hour manhunt before they finally caught him. The defendant said this morning that he wishes to plead guilty, but at this stage, that's not allowed. First, he chose to dismiss his jury and officially move forward with a panel of three judges. That's how he'll be tried, so to speak. He has to wait until the panel of judges is seated to enter the official plea.
You understand this right that is afforded to you by the constitutions of this state and the United States, that for a jury trial cannot be taken away from you by anybody else. Do you recognize that?
I completely recognize, Your Honor. I also know that the jury did a lot of work to come here, and I do trust them with all my heart. But I do believe this is a great decision for me, and I will relinquish that right.
And also, I want you to be fully cognizant of this, because if I decide to grant this waiver, we went through 3 weeks of jury selection. You've been there for the entire process. You know the work that has been put in on whittling that field from starting out 500 jurors to get down to the 12 jurors and four alternates we have in the box right now. If there's anything about this decision that is sitting on your mind and thinking that this strategically, this could be, you've seen your jury now, and strategically saying, I want to waive my jury, my right to a jury trial, and then turn right around and say, now I want to withdraw my waiver after I dismiss this jury, I'm proceeding.
I understand.
And I will have the judges in the panel, and we will start it. And it'll be a public trial just as this, only there won't be anybody sitting in the jury box.
The judge reminded the defendant that there's nearly no going back from this step. The next step, again, is that three-judge panel.
It'll be me and two other judges appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Ohio. The same three judges will, upon the completion of a sentencing hearing, determine if the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt, again, the state carrying the burden, and that burden being having to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, whether the aggravating circumstances that are alleged by the state outweigh any and all mitigating factors which may be put before the court. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
That is the same process that we would be going through if we had 12 jurors decide this case. The only difference is we're moving from 12 jurors to three judges in that regard for sentencing. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
Next, the judge made it official. This will not be a jury trial. It will officially be a trial, so to speak, by a three-judge panel.
Having made inquiry of the defendant, the court hearing grants the waiver of trial by jury signed and approved by the defendant and certified by his counsel. The court finds said waiver of trial by jury to have been knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily made by the defendant entered this 12th day of February 2019. Have I read all the information or all the words on this order, waiver of trial by jury and certification accurately into the record, Mr. Lawson?
Yes, sir.
And this is your last opportunity. Is this what you want?
Yes, sir.
And is this request for a waiver of jury trial knowingly and intelligently made?
Yes, sir.
And are you making it voluntarily?
Yes, sir.
Joining me tonight are attorneys Julie Rendleman and Imran Ansari. Sir Imran, let me start with you. This is an interesting procedural move, a bench trial And then once jeopardy attaches, I assume here, the defendant promises to plead guilty in front of the panel. What's your analysis of the procedural move here?
Well, you know, we just went through 3 weeks of jury selection on this case. He's made a critical decision at this point that the judge is making sure that he has made knowingly, voluntarily, that he's waiving that trial by jury and he's going before this this panel. He intends to plead guilty before this panel, and then ultimately it's going to be up for this panel to enter the sentencing phase. The death penalty is on the line here. I'm sure his attorneys are hoping that the judge looks at this case and ends up sending him to a life sentence rather than the chair.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate question here. Julie, I was going to ask you this. You're the former prosecutor here. So, you know, the defendant, even if he goes ahead and pleads guilty, then the prosecution can turn around and say, no, your honors, we're going to now prove that the crimes were aggravated. And the judges could still send him to death row. So this was not an attempt, or if it was an attempt, it wasn't successful, to try to get the death penalty off the table.
Yeah, no, look, you never know what's in someone's mind. He sat through 3 weeks of jury selection. He may be looking at the jurors going, I don't think that they're going to side with me, and I don't think they're going to have any sympathy towards whatever mitigation I've thought of. And so he may think he has a better shot with the three panel judges. I don't know. Maybe this is something that his attorneys thought was the better route. Time will tell.
Yeah, okay. I mean, we have a dead child among the victims here, so that's not going to help garner him any sympathy in front of the jury. But Imran, apparently the defendant's attorneys did not want him to go this way. They advised him against it, and that was on the record today. So is this a case where the client is sitting there finally looking at the people who would choose his fate, and he gets nervous and says, no, I want to go this way?
Right. It could be that case. It could be a case with the client, with the defendant, having some pre-opening statement jitters. His attorneys advised him against it, but ultimately it's the client's decision.
It happens from time to time. We'll check in with you both again at the end of the broadcast. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the killing of a Georgia beauty queen. The defendant's DNA at the scene, still the defense picks a fight in court with the lead investigator. That is when The Debrief continues. Welcome back to The Debrief, ladies and gentlemen. A pretrial hearing pushed into the evening yesterday in a cold case murder of a Georgia beauty queen. Ryan Duke is charged with aggravated assault, burglary, and murder in the death and disappearance of Tara Grinstead. Grinstead disappeared from her Ocilla, Georgia home in October 2005. Grinstead was a beauty queen and teacher who crossed paths with Duke, the defendant, at the high school where she taught history and where he was a student. The hearing turned into a miniature trial. Here, the lead investigator in the case said the defendant confessed to the murder and even explained why he did it.
Did the defendant, Ryan Duke, specifically indicate who had killed Tara Grinstead?
He admitted that he was the person responsible.
Did he indicate to you whether or not anyone else was present at the time that he murdered Tara Grinstead?
He said he was by himself. I asked him numerous times during the interview if there was somebody else there that, you know, he needed to tell me about it. Each time he indicated he was by himself the entire time. Nobody helped him. He, once again, multiple times said he was by himself. Nobody else was with him.
Now, did the defendant indicate to you why he was in Tara Grinstead's home in the first place that evening or early morning hours?
He did. He said during his interview that at the time he was involved in drugs and alcohol pretty heavily, and that it influenced a lot of his decision making, and that he had gone to her house to steal money to pay for his habit.
Did he indicate to you whether or not he had ever broken into anyone else's home for that same reason?
He said during the interview that he had, you know, he was casing homes, but he didn't indicate any other person's home he broke into.
And did you ask him how he got into, or did he tell you how he got into her home?
He told me.
And what did he tell you about how he got into her home?
He said he used a credit card to pick the lock on her door and went into the house.
Now,
or a card of some kind, credit card.
Did the defendant, this defendant, indicate to you how he murdered Tara Grinstead?
He did.
What did he tell you about that?
He said as he was going through her purse, trying to find money, that somehow Tara surprised him, said something to him, and that he turned and out of reaction, he punched her and hit her.
From there, the investigator said the defendant became scared. So he ran to his own house, picked up gloves and a blanket, and then brought them back to wrap up Tara Grinstead's body. The glove would cause that defendant trouble, and we'll get to that in just a minute. First, though, the rest of the defendant's version of what he did with Tara Grinstead.
And I was trying to get him to elaborate a little further as to how he carried her body out. And I said, well, you know, did you put her over your shoulder? You know, what was going on? And what I thought was interesting about what he did at that point was he immediately involuntarily reacted and put his arms up as in this carry, like this is how he carried her out. And he immediately had an emotional response to that. He started crying and upset, and which even to me indicated he's reliving this moment right now, the feelings that he had, this, you know, what was going on.
Did this defendant, Ryan Duke, tell you how he disposed of the body of Tara Grinstead?
Yes.
Okay. What did he tell you about how he disposed of her body?
Very similar to the story that Bo gave. He went out. He talked about taking Bo back out there to the orchard that Wednesday after Bo questioned him about what had happened, and that he took her out there to where the body was, and that they loaded the body up. They drove her body out into the pine trees, and that they burned her. The word he used was cremated. He said they cremated her body over the next two or three days.
If we are to believe this witness, this is the defendant's own version of what he did to Tara Grinstead. The defense, however, has some issues with the story. Let's jump ahead to cross-examination.
Do you believe that Tara was killed by strangulation?
I believe what Ryan told me.
You believe that she was killed not by strangulation, then?
I believe that he said he struck her and he killed her.
You believe he said he struck her and killed her?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe he struck her and killed her?
That's what I just said.
Okay. Do you believe that she was killed by one hit to the face?
You want my opinion?
I want what you believe.
I said this as much during the interview that I said that it was possible during the interview with Ryan that he could have done that. I asked him, based on the knowledge that what Bo had told me, whether or not he strangled her, and he also said that it was possible. Ryan said that it was possible that he strangled her as well. So I believe what he told me, that he struck her, and I also believe that it's possible versus that he strangled her as well.
You believe that it's possible that Ryan strangled her?
Correct.
Okay.
And both. It could be both.
You're testifying that he told you that it was possible he strangled her?
Yes, he did.
That's your memory of his interview with you?
Mm-hmm.
But Ryan never told you that he put trash on top of Ms. Grinstead's body?
He said they put garbage on her. They put garbage on her on the fire to make it look like a party.
And you assumed that was on top of her, where she had been burned?
Based on the conversation that we were having at the time, yes.
Okay. But it's possible it was near that site to make it look like a party.
You're asking me to speculate again. I'm just telling you what I believe.
I'm not.
Is that he, when we were talking, he told me that I, based on the conversation we were having, that I was taking it, that he said he put the trash on the fire, which was, there wasn't a fire 10 feet from Tara's body. There wasn't a fire 100 feet from Tara's body. There was a fire on Tara's body.
And in other words, there was just one fire. Look, the defense seems to be zeroing in on precisely what was found in that fire pit. Is there no evidence of human remains whatsoever? Maybe there isn't. We're going to have to wait and see how this shakes out come trial. But the defense did reveal one huge piece of evidence yesterday. It's that latex glove the defendant accidentally left behind. It links one defendant to the scene, but not the other.
Is there any physical evidence to show that Bo Duke was ever inside or near the home of Tara Grinstead during the time of her murder?
No.
Is there any physical evidence to show that Ryan Duke was either inside or near her residence at the time of her murder?
Yes.
What is that physical evidence?
There was a latex glove found at the residence in front of her house. There was a latex glove found the day of the investigation, the initiation of the investigation. That glove was subsequently sent to our crime lab and both tested for fingerprints and DNA evidence. The prints couldn't be, there wasn't enough points there to make a comparison. But there was a DNA that was obtained from the glove. And how we knew that the glove was connected to the residents and Ms. Grinstead, which is something that we never put out, was that also on the glove was Tara's DNA.
During the interview with this defendant, was he able to describe to you what the latex glove was that he used?
He did.
And what was the description that he gave?
He said it was like the brownish translucent. He gave the description of the glove.
Back to the panel one last time tonight. So let me throw this out for discussion. Triple denial here for the defense. No bond, no change of venue, no investigator to look into the background of the jurors. Were these things that they really needed? Imran, let me start with you.
Well, okay. So, I mean, you think the defense, at this point, they brought this hearing. They requested this hearing, trying to get bond for the client. Defendant has been in jail since 2017. This bond hearing ended up being like a mini trial, as you described earlier. You have a lot of evidence out there, a lot of things that possibly they didn't expect to come out at the time when they called this hearing. I don't think it was necessary.
Well, they did get a lot of key pieces of evidence in here, Julie. They got a great chance to basically cross-examine the lead investigator and to try to shoehorn him into specific theories here.
Smartest decision they ever made, and quite frankly, I think it's the silliest decision the prosecution made, because the prosecutor didn't have to call these witnesses. The prosecution had the testimony from the defense of the brother, who, quite frankly, after he testified, no judge was ever going to let this guy out on bond. So I don't know why the prosecution felt the need to bring out the entire case, so now the defense has an opportunity to cross them not once, but as we talked about before, twice.
Yeah, okay, so what's going on here with the defense really trying to slice and dice this very thinly here? Was she struck? Was she strangled? Are they to believe, or are they going to try to convince a jury that this young woman was killed by merely being struck somehow? And then he ran out because he got scared, and then he came back with gloves and a blanket. Something else was going on here, because the original version of the story was that he struck her. That doesn't kill somebody. It might incapacitate somebody. Imran, what do you think?
Well, you strike someone hard enough, it can kill someone, right?
Well,
but,
yeah. Okay.
So, but, you know, again, the evidence is coming out through this hearing that, you know, wasn't necessarily out there before. Yep, the defense gets a chance to know what the prosecution witness is going to be saying, but also we, you know, on the other side, you have this evidence coming out, or this testimony coming out through the defendant's brother, which also corroborates a lot of the evidence against the defendant.
Julie, what do you think?
I think, you know, look, the prosecution is going to have to deal with that inconsistency, because there's some testimony, going to be some evidence that it's one way, some evidence that's the other, and they're going to have to kind of convince the jury and buy what he's selling in terms of his confession.
I said it was a miniature trial. That's what we saw. So this is a look at what's going to come in the Tara Grinstead case when it goes to trial. Thanks a lot to you both for joining us, and thanks to you for watching the Daily Debrief tonight. I'll see you right back here tomorrow at 4 o'clock, an hour earlier, because the McStay family murder case will be back in session. Have a good night. Our live coverage starts tomorrow at 9 a.m.